Cairo Radio's in-house historian Felix Bunnell is here and just can't get over how exciting and how historic the recent snowstorm was. That, of course, the most famous parody to be spawned by the storm from somebody who's trapped in a house with only a piano and some inspiration. So give us the historic precedence for this.
Well, I mean, the thesis I'm defending is that this was Seattle's first ever social media snowstorm.
Ah.
And so I checked in with a bunch of people. The previous big snowstorm here of any consequence was back in December 2008. That's just a year into the iPhone era. I think there were 100 million Facebook users at that point, and now there's 2.3 billion. So this storm, if you logged on to Facebook or Twitter, it played out in real time, and it was pretty fascinating to watch. But what does this all mean, you might be asking yourself? Well, to find out, I checked in with three local experts to get their sense of how Seattle's first social media snowstorm was different than anything we'd seen before. For one thing, future historians are going to have a mountain of images and other data to sift through to understand how people experienced the 2019 snow. That's what my friend, the photographer Gene Sherrard, told me. He collaborates with Paul Dorpat each week on the Seattle Times Now and Then feature. Gene's dug through archives looking back at earlier snows like 1880, 1916, 1915, or excuse me, 1950, and he was taking pictures and tuned into social media this time around.
Going back 100 years, you know, whether it's the Seattle snow in 1880, where there's only a dozen images, or the Seattle fire 9 years later, you only have a handful of images, so it kind of makes each one a little more precious. And what does that say about how we value images today when in place of a dozen, we have a million?
Yeah, and Gene says that because of those sheer numbers, the real trick for those future historians will be sorting out the useful images and data from the bad stuff. He thinks ultimately there will be some form of artificial intelligence for that kind of thing. Now, one organization that was sorting the social media snowstorm pictures and data in real time was the Seattle Office of the National Weather Service. Meteorologist Courtney Obergfell there told me that the stream of photos and reports shared by Facebook and Twitter by civilians helped the Weather Service keep the information they were putting out to the public up to date.
We received probably over 1,000 reports over the last few weeks of what was happening where people live. So all across our area, we got an idea of, was it raining? Was it snowing? If it was snowing, how much it was snowing, what the winds were like. And really, it was a give and take, so we could feed that information back to everybody else and update our forecast pretty rapidly as the event was evolving.
Yeah, and Courtney Obergfell says that it made a difference if people were seeing information shared by the Weather Service, but it was information that had originated from their peers. And that, of course, is what social media is all about. One thing in all those pictures that were being shared, it seemed to me like the official image of this snowstorm was either those empty grocery store shelves or my personal favorite, the yardstick or ruler in the backyard snowbank. As it turns out, those ruler pics are actually pretty useful to the Weather Service.
Yeah, and we really like those pictures because it gives us, you know, they're actually measurements versus somebody said, oh, I got about a foot, but you don't really know. The actual rulers and those kind of imagery is great for us to get a more accurate sense of what's going on.
I took one. I know you should send it to the Weather Service. So they have an actual website for that?
By Twitter, people were sharing stuff to the Weather Service, and the Weather Service was sharing it. It was incredible. I mean, that's what this social media snowstorm, what it was really all about. And so I checked in with Hansen Hossein. He's director of the UW Communication Leadership Master's Program. He monitors social and cultural impact of communications technologies year-round. He was watching during the storm. He agrees this was definitely the first big Seattle snow of the social media age, but he has mixed feelings as to whether it was all positive. I asked him if the sharing that took place during the storm is one of the unequivocally good things about social media. He said, on one hand, yes.
We probably saw a lot of examples of people just helping out neighbors and strangers along the way that didn't necessarily require social media to be documenting it, but it did get documented from people, you know, clearing each other's walks and driveways to helping cars that are stuck in snow. I think it's a wonderful sort of citizen-led expression of who we are and how we react under stress. It might be a great dress rehearsal for when we have the earthquake and the apocalypse truly happens.
Yeah, try getting Wi-Fi or a Zig signal. Yeah. But Hansen Hossein also sees reason for concern in the pictures of snowy streets and icy sidewalks and sledding parties that so many of us shared.
So all of the stuff that we've shared can be leveraged mostly for good in terms of, well, we can predict where the snow and ice might happen next time this occurs so that we can be more proactive about it. And we also have a lot more facial recognition of our kids and how we drove and how we behaved during this. So when the masters that are, you know, 20 years from now want to assign us social credits, those who were good at cleaning their ice and snow from their sidewalks and documented as such might get, you know, more food rations when the next crisis hits.
I'm glad he laughed when he said that, because I thought that was a pretty gloomy assessment. And I guess maybe only time will tell if it's accurate. But my last question was for Hansen Hossein was if he saw any of those cool pictures of yardsticks or rulers stuck in the snow.
I think the ruler and the snowbank was the new was the new communication, I don't know, meme in this particular storm. I'd never seen that before. I grew up in Canada where snow could go up to your roof. We never put rulers in the snow, but that's Seattle for you, right? We're all very data-centric.
Well, if it goes up to your roof, you don't need a rule. You need a tape measure.
Yeah, and I did see some tape measure photographs, but it really was strange. I mean, the storm really was exciting, more exciting than any previous storm, because we had traditional media like Cairo Radio giving us updates, but then all the neighbors and everybody were posting these pictures, and it was all going on real time, and the government was using that to create better forecasts and accurately assess how much snow was falling. That's new for Seattle. Might happen every year in other parts of the country, but this was, it's a big deal. We survived our first social media snowstorm. Thank God.
Yes, we did. Thank you, Felix. Felix Spinell joins us each Wednesday with a look back at the area's history, and you can find all his features at mynorthwest.com. Hannah Scott is here. She's been looking into two measures in Olympia. One of them expands the scope of the red flag laws. Those are the laws that allow people's gun rights to be taken away because of things they're threatening to do. And the other involves calling a hate crime a hate crime. So tell us about it.
So a state Senate panel got to hear from folks on both of these proposals yesterday. The one is to expand the use of extreme risk protection orders to include hate crime threats. What the bill does would allow a judge who grants these orders to also include hate threats as things that they would consider before granting them. Some at the hearing yesterday, though, wondered why that change was even necessary, since judges can consider now threats in general. But Senator Marco Lea says with the latest numbers from the FBI showing hate crimes jumped 32% in our state in 2017, his bill is about taking a stand.
It's true that judges and others can already weigh these factors, but I think it's important in light of the disturbing acts of violence in Charleston and other places that we make it crystal clear to our community and to the judicial community that this is an important value and priority of the legislature.
And former federal prosecutor David Hackney highlighted exactly why he thinks it's necessary.
We have seen time and time again the deadly intersection of hate and gun violence, and these incidents are etched into our mind. The Pulse nightclub in Orlando, the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, and the Jewish Federation in Greater Seattle. Each of these instances is a devastating example of how guns turned hate into deadly force.
But Katie Hopkins with the NRA told lawmakers this was an overreach.
The language being added is vague and provides no clear standard as to what makes a threat credible. Rhode Island recently considered similar language for their red flag law, and the ACLU strongly opposed it because of the danger of using political rhetoric to remove a constitutional right.
Now, I did reach out to the ACLU on this particular bill, and I did not hear back. They did not testify yesterday at this hearing. I'm not sure where they land on this. Another bill before the Senate committee would make a hate crime in Washington state. Right now, we do not have anything that's called a hate crime charge or law. What we do have is malicious harassment. It's essentially the same thing, but this bill would basically change the law to call a hate crime what it is, a hate crime. Why does that matter? Mary Cyphers with the Anti-Defamation League had the answer.
These measures, though they are symbolic, can send a message that Washington will not tolerate bias and bigotry. SB 5850 would also establish an advisory working group to provide recommendations to the legislature by July 2020 on the prevention of hate crimes through community awareness, law enforcement training, and victim support. These are critical components of a holistic approach to tackling hate.
So several people actually spoke at this hearing and really drove home personally why this was a big issue for them and why they wanted that law changed.
My wife, who's a wife, a daughter, a mother, a veteran, and also a trans person, she was attacked on Capitol Hill or in the Central District in Seattle for being trans, for being visibly trans.
Recent anti-Semitic crimes here in the Puget Sound included personal threats against Jewish teachers, swastikas painted on elementary schools and Jewish homes, and Jewish books destroyed in libraries, just to name a few.
We are aware of members in our Latino communities on both sides of the mountains being intimidated, harassed, assaulted for the color of skin, the language they speak, being asked to go back to the country.
All right, well, these are all bad things, but I mean, is this, have we not had laws? I thought we had laws to deal with all these things.
Again, and as they said, this is somewhat symbolic. It's about really sending a message that we are in Washington State, a hate-free zone. We don't tolerate hate. And it's odd to some of these folks that we have malicious harassment on the books as opposed to just calling a hate crime a hate crime. So that's one of the pushes here. This bill also, though, has the Attorney General create a work group, I believe, in time for next year to come up with ways to like a campaign to prevent hate crimes, maybe a campaign, things like that. So they really dive in and take a close look. It also allows for civil lawsuits for up to $250,000 for certain hate crimes.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit more.
Well, absent, you know, brain transplants for certain people who are never going to change. I don't know what you do. I mean, is there any question but that we do prosecute hate crimes when there's evidence of one?
I mean, and I don't think that's it. But I think that there are hate crimes, and like they said, you know, the FBI latest numbers for 2017, 17% increase in hate crimes across the country, 32% in our state for that same period. It's big. We hear about them all the time. So those people who are maybe behind these types of crimes, whether they be violence or, you know, like
they don't care about the laws. That's clear.
But so the idea is to get a campaign out there, really show that we're not just idly sitting by. I mean, sure, you prosecute, but like I said, have the AG look at a campaign, a public awareness campaign, that we do not tolerate this. That's, I think, what all of this looks at.
I know the pushback on this, I'm not sure about you mentioned the ACLU, but yeah. I know there's some people who will say, well, wait a minute, if I wear a red MAGA hat and somebody doesn't like that, can I get accused of a hate crime?
And I'm sure that's part of the discussion. I didn't hear it yesterday at this committee hearing, but certainly overall, I think that it goes both ways. And we see that kind of right now with the Jussie Smollett situation where because he had said possibly that there was MAGA hats involved.
Well, he's got more.
So there's a lot
more
other
problems
stuff.
Just that there.
But both sides, you see the rhetoric that has come up on both sides of that because of that.
Apparently he wrote his own threatening note.
Well,
I mean,
we'll see.
Making false accusations is also against the law, correct?
It is against the law. I did some digging on that yesterday. And the biggest thing here is that for those who are victims of hate crimes, anyone who makes a false hate crime report, it really is bad for those who really go through this. It will, it's like, you know, filing a false sexual assault report, right? It's going to make people who are actual victims not willing to come forward or less likely to come forward. And it's just negative in that aspect. As far as the punishment for something like this, though, I looked into what it would be. It's false. It's just filing a false report.
Yeah.
King County Prosecutor's Office tells me that would be up to 364 days in jail. And really, there's no difference. Even if you stage an actual crime to support your false report, I did a lot of digging yesterday. I couldn't find out any extra charges that would come along with that.
Yeah. But that, just to make it clear, that's against the law, too.
That is against the law. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Up to a year in jail. You bet.
Car Radio's Hannah Scott. We've all been thumbing through the latest New York Times piece, which indicates the president was doing a great deal to derail the various investigations into what he may have or may have not done, which I think we're all aware of. We called up CBS News correspondent Major Garrett at the White House to sort out exactly what is new in this Times investigation.
Well, there is a specific allegation that related to the investigation of Mr. Trump's former lawyer and fixer and confidant, Michael Cohen, the president asked his acting attorney general to see if he could use his power to install someone at the head of that investigation in New York that the president regarded as an ally. Who was that person? Jeffrey Berman. According to the New York Times, Matt Whitaker, the acting attorney general, said, Mr. President, I can't do that. He's already, that is to say, Berman, recused himself, so I can't put him in charge of an investigation he's recused himself from because he's an ally of yours. So this would fall into the category of things the president either talked about at some level, we don't know how seriously, that didn't happen, which meant it didn't derail or interfere with an investigation. Clearly, Michael Cohen is evidence of that. He's going to go to prison here in the not-too-distant future. And yet, it falls into this category of the president asking or talking about something that looks completely wrong. Completely wrong. But not, as a lawyer might say, exculpatory. It doesn't take the president off the hook.
Yeah.
The other question that this story raises, Dave, is did Matt Whitaker, the acting attorney general, tell the truth when he was questioned repeatedly by House Judiciary Committee Democrats about whether or not he had any conversations with the president about any ongoing investigation? And he was asked specifically a number of questions about any conversations with the president dealing with anything the Southern District of New York for the U.S. Attorney's Office was investigating. Whitaker said, I had no conversations with the president about any investigations, and that includes the Southern District of New York. Does that open him up to charges of potentially perjuring himself? Don't know, but House Democrats are asking that question out loud.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the politics of this. Larry Hogan, Republican governor of Maryland, was on CBS this morning. He was openly fretting about the president's prospects for reelection. He's saying that they're looking at like 30% in some cases. So what's the talk around the Capitol?
Well, the president has a base that likes him, but not much else. And going into 2020, he's not as formidable as he thinks he is. And I've talked to people in the Trump inner circle who have told me that they've told the president, look, you drew an inside straight in 2016. You pulled everything that you could get out of an electorate and had a Democratic opponent who did not, who underperformed, still won the popular vote, but not the electoral vote. And if you think you have a chance of winning the popular vote, you're seriously misguided. And if you think that electoral map is still going to work in your favor based on where you are now, that's not likely. And you should prepare yourself either to switch around your campaign, do things differently, or understand that the odds are against you. So is this incumbent, by definition, formidable just because he's an incumbent? I'm not so sure. There's been a tremendous counterreaction to the Trump approach to the presidency, a very deep grassroots counterreaction among Democrats, progressives, and the like. And you can only look at the number of Democrats running who are serious about this. They believe President Trump is beatable, and they're in the game to get the chance to do exactly that. Whoever the nominee is, beat President Trump. So you have a unifying force in the Republican Party that's mobilizing the opposition party. That's not always so good.
CBS News correspondent Major Garrett joining us from the White House. He also hosts The Takeout, which you can hear Sundays here on Cairo Radio.
It's your daily dose of kindness. Actually, a couple doses of kindness of different persuasions. I just couldn't decide. The first, just another example of teachers going above and beyond. For many students, no school can mean no meal that day. But in Campbell County, West Virginia, where teachers really across the state are on strike, some spent the day cooking and delivering meals to those kids instead. About a dozen other churches and community centers across that county joined in. Some served hot meals in-house, but other teachers personally delivered those meals to their students, knowing that they didn't want them to go hungry that day. In addition, the schools in the county have food pantries. One serves about 100 students each week, giving each student two lunches, three dinners, and three breakfasts so they can get through the weekend. Then we head to Syracuse, New York, where you'll get something extra special in your Taco Bell drive-thru order. There is a clerk there that, according to coworkers, radiates positivity. She's passing that on now, slipping sweet notes into the bags of takeaway. From simple notes to quotes by Mark Twain, Albert Einstein, Vincent Van Gogh, this 27-year-old has written hundreds of notes, she says, to surprise her customers. She got the idea when Taco Bell and other retailers do this. They require employees to put those promotional surveys in the receipts, and they want you to take that survey for your chance to win, blah de blah. Well, she noticed a small blank spot on the receipts and thought, that'd be the perfect spot for an inspirational pick-me-up. She told WGRZ-TV, I may just work at a fast food place, but you have to take pride in what you do, especially with how hard today's times are. It's nice to put a smile on someone's face.
A personal touch. Time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Our insider happens to be Danny O'Neill.
Hi!
Who knows everything about giant contracts. Used to be that Alex Rodriguez had the record, right? He was the last record holder for a major league contract.
The current largest contract in professional sports. It's not A-Rod's got two of the five biggest.
Yeah.
I don't know if he has the actual largest. If that's what Manny Machado.
But when he landed one of his largest, everybody was like, oh my God, this is the death of baseball.
Well, he had a provision that he had to be a dollar more than everybody else, right?
No, he was many more than a dollar more.
Well,
it was 1999, and it was a 10-year, $250 million contract.
Yeah.
And that was a landmark, and it's still a pretty big, massive chunk of money. He later negotiated a $275 million contract.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should have heard of Manny Machado, but I have to admit this is the first I've heard of
him. I haven't heard of Manny Machado.
Neither
have I. Manny Machado.
Machado, okay. Well, I haven't heard of him either. So what makes him worth $300 million? I realize it's over 10 years, but it's still $300 million.
26 years old. He plays shortstop and extremely productive offensive hitter. His home runs, the power numbers he has in addition to his average. He's not a great defensive player, but the fact that he does play shortstop, you're not comparing him to what's the next best offensive player. You're comparing him to the next best offensive shortstop, and the gap there between he and the next guy, it's such a valuable component because that's typically and traditionally a non-hitting position. So your ability to find that kind of production from that position is so difficult. That's the rationale for why. And can you expect him to be a productive player for 10 more years? Yeah, you can.
What's the top paid player on the Mariners? Who is that?
Now it's, well, Felix has Felix. 1 year. Felix
but
has.
It was only $25 million, right?
It's 27 per year.
Oh, per year.
Correct.
Well,
Felix has 1 year left. Okay. This is at the end of that contract.
So what was the total, though?
At the time he signed it, I think it was a 6-year contract.
Oh, okay.
It was an extension that was tacked on to his current deal.
So nowhere close to what the...
Baseball, the contract should be measured by how far out you can project the income, not what you're making on an
and
annual
it's all
basis.
Guaranteed.
Correct. He's going to get that $300 million.
Wow.
And but when we all look at it, and you're like, oh my gosh, what's the difference? I'm surprised more teams weren't willing to pay it. And if I was a San Francisco Giants fan right now, I would be screaming at them to sign Bryce Harper to that deal, if not bigger.
Why didn't they? There's no cap, right?
Correct. There's no cap, and these teams roll in money because of the local TV contracts that they have. I think that there's the baseball right now is their financial system is messed up. It's completely jacked up, evidenced by the fact that Manny Machado is being signed as spring training starting. And the best comparison I heard was that this is like putting up your Christmas tree on December 23rd. You should have a whole offseason to get excited if you're the San Diego Padres about Manny Machado. There's players out there. Dallas Keuchel's a former Cy Young Award winner. He's not signed right now. Bryce Harper is every bit as good and every bit as valuable and probably going to get every bit as big a contract as Machado. He's unsigned right now. And it's because teams, there is something going on in baseball right now. The players will tell you it's collusion. The owners will tell you that, no, we've become smarter about building teams. But teams are not spending money like they should, is what I would say. They're not spending money like you would justify it in saying that, okay, we've got this pool of resources for our salaries, and we should get the best players we can with this money to project out to field the most competitive team possible. That's not happening right now.
Any evidence the Mariners are willing to shell out some big bucks to, I shouldn't say rebuild their team?
Right now?
What word should I use?
Well, right now, no, because that's the process. They've gone down that road before, and they have spent big, and it's not put them in the playoffs. Even before Robinson Cano, Adrian Beltre and Richie Sexton were two top-tier free agents that they signed, and that put them over the top. They're taking a different tact right now.
Okay.
San Diego, who signed Machado, they've got the best farm system in baseball, and what that means is that they believe they've got this nucleus of young talent coming up through their farm system that's about to be cost-controlled, and they're going to marry it with a star player, and hopefully that puts them over the top. If you sign one of these players to these huge contracts and you don't get into the playoffs, then you're stuck because you have a massive amount of resources sunk into a player who is, by all projections, at some point going to start getting worse. Mm-hmm. Now, the Mariners did it with Cano, who was already in his 30s. Mm-hmm. Machado's a better bet, but the idea that at 35 he's going to be worth $30 million, probably not, but at 26 he might be worth more than $30 million.
But, you know, in 10 years, $30 million is not going to be worth $30 million.
Yeah, it will. Yeah, it's still going to be $30 million. Yes, it will still be $30 million, Dave.
I don't think
if you can't find a way to save a few dollars when you get a $300 million contract, then good, you deserve to go broke.
Don't you kind of feel like you would have some fun with that, though? If you were going to go broke making that much money, you would do some ludicrous stuff.
You end up getting surrounded by all sorts of people who are telling you how to spend your money.
Yeah, which is a bad way to spend your money. You should spend it on hedonistic pleasures.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will bathe in ice cream.
Go watch Brewster. Go watch Brewster's Millions.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Baseball and spending money.
That is a great movie.
It is a very good and underrated movie. Richard
so by
Pryor.
My calculation, he had 188 hits. So if he continues at that pace, that's $159,574 a hit.
Heck yeah. Mwah. Worth every penny.
Okay.
More teams should be paying that.
Don't you wish you could earn that just by cracking the mic, Dave?
I'm just disappointed. I wasted all that time learning how to pitch. Yeah. I should have been learning how to hit.
That's true.
Yeah.
Although if you could strike out Machado, if you could give somebody the shot, if you just get the chance, if you're like, if I will not settle for a penny less than the man I struck out.
Machado said the ball was so slow I didn't know how to hit it.
Hey, we're not gonna complain about the process. Just show me the results.
Let's see him handle my 37 mile an hour changeup.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, but when your fastball is 38, is that really a changeup?
Yeah, that's the problem. You just need sequencing. You need a little distance between the two pitches.
As long as I throw it in the right direction. Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Our Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealer. President Trump has officially directed the Pentagon to establish a Space Force as the sixth branch of the armed forces. Let's bring in a retired major from one of the original Earthbound branches of the service, CBS military analyst Major Mike Lyons. So what will the Space Force's role be? Do they take over running NASA, or do we already have – we have military satellites in space already, right, Mike?
No, we do, and I think Space Force has a real mission, and that's to defend those assets that we have in outer space. Most of them have got to do with our geographic and space mapping type operations that we do here, geospacing. And without our GPS systems, I think we'd be in a lot of trouble. So, it's a good way to go. It's our other adversaries have looked to weaponize space already, and I think it's going to serve as the right platform if you look over the horizon as to what we should be doing.
So this would involve defending basically our electronic assets in space.
Right. Defending those assets that circle the globe, allow us to position our cars and position things, as well as look at things over the horizon, make sure we understand what's going on from a scientific perspective. And then it'll serve as a platform to potentially defend those things. I think, you go back to the Reagan era where we had Star Wars actual weapon systems in space that were used to fire at intercontinental ballistic missiles. That technology is not been developed, but if it can be imagined, it may be something that can be developed. So it'll give us a foundation in order to do the things to protect the country.
I'm trying to figure out how this would work, though. So you'd put up defensive satellites, which presumably, well, they wouldn't use kinetic things, right? Because then they would sort of be in orbit forever, but they would fire lasers at an aggressive satellite trying to attack us or something like that?
Well, it's hard to say specifically how that would go, but what it's going to do, though, it's going to put a command and control center and a real focus as to what's happening in our atmosphere beyond just what the Air Force does, which controls obviously a significant portion of that. And the Air Force, in fact, is going to control the Space Force initially. What the president put out yesterday was something that said it's going to come from the Air Force, similar to the way the Air Force came from the Army. But it'll really make sure that they have to focus on specifically operations that are taking place in space, inventory not only what we're doing, but what everybody else is doing, and then look to use that again as that platform to defend our assets here.
One thing the Space Force does not have yet, as I understand it, is a service anthem. There have been several suggested. Were you aware of this?
No, I'm sure there's several out there that they could go for sure. And
I wanted to run some of them by you, since you are a military person. This one is by a guy named Mike Wazolek. Space Force! Space Force! It's a little repetitive, but then it wouldn't be too hard to memorize. Here's one by the Gregory Brothers. Again, very simple lyrics.
Yeah.
And then Samantha Bee had one.
Space Force, Space Force, we ride into battle on a Space Horse, of course.
Pew. Pew, 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 pew.
I'm a little worried that America's composers are not taking this seriously.
That doesn't sound like it. I mean, what that first one sounded like it was Trapped in Time from the 1960s.
Yes.
I think, it's got to be something that people are going to want to stand at attention, kind of pop their chest up,
yes,
feel proud about, and just a tear comes to their eye when that comes out. And if they're a member of that Space Force, they're gonna be extra motivated to do their job.
Exactly. Something you have to be able to sing comfortably while weightless, I would think.
Yeah, that's true, too. And upside down in all different – every position possible.
Mike Lyons, thank you, as always, for your military advice.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Many high schools here in Washington already educate students about what happened during the Holocaust, and now there's a push in Olympia to expand that education to younger students, middle school students. Let's go to KyRadio's Hannah Scott.
Dave, this is really part of a national effort right now that was at least in part prompted by a recent study that found many millennials don't know much at all about the Holocaust, including two-thirds who have no idea what Auschwitz is. Right now in Washington State, all public high schools are strongly encouraged to include the Holocaust in their curriculum. Republican Senator Ann Rivers says her bill would expand that strong recommendation to middle and junior high schools.
It's so very important because if we think about history, we know that those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. And I think there's probably no finer example in the history of humankind than this as being something that should never be repeated.
D. Simon with the Holocaust Center for Humanity here in Seattle told the Senate panel this week, including this education is not just about the history of it.
Teachers are telling us that they are concerned about the bias and discrimination that's happening in our schools today. They want to provide a safe environment for all of their students. The Holocaust really has been shown in numerous studies to be an effective way teachers can teach about the escalation of bigotry and discrimination. It's a way that they can teach students about how to stop the pyramid of hate at its base, where scapegoating and stereotyping begin.
Others came to share more personal reasons for their support, including Peter Menslar.
I am a Holocaust survivor from Holland. Mom and I survived this dark, nightmarish time history because of Mom's strength, cunning, and courage of others willing to risk their and their families' lives to hide us. I have documented proof that the rest of my entire family were killed in Auschwitz, all because there were people who saw our family and millions of others as different.
He's been sharing his story as part of Holocaust education in high schools in our state for years and hopes to keep doing so as long as he can. And he says that education is vital for the future of our communities.
Holocaust education and the teaching of all genocides creates awareness and makes a huge difference in the development of minds of youth. I tell my story as a representative of all areas of communities which today, sadly, are experiencing the land of tolerance and unfounded hatred. The future of the communities, as well as all of society, lies with our kids, but they have to be taught to recognize festering of hatred and lack of understanding.
Kamiak High School teacher Brand Anderson also told lawmakers why he believed this should be expanded to the younger students.
As an educator, I believe that studying the Holocaust is an educational imperative. Though the Holocaust seems incomprehensible, it is not, and that's why our students must engage in the study. The Holocaust opens up truth about the capacity of humans for not only hatred, but indifference to their neighbors. It helps students engage in critical thinking about the role of scapegoating, greed, and racism in what was a watershed moment for humanity. To ask what difference that can and should be made to help a democratic society function and protect all people, not just people like them.
Nobody spoke out against this at this particular hearing. Some of the concerns that tend to come up, especially when we're talking about middle or junior high school students, is, you know, is it too dark for kids of that age? So what this bill does is direct the state school superintendent office to come up with age appropriate recommendations, I believe, a year from now. And then down the line, it also they would have to get feedback on everyone who's following those guidelines and implementing this education in their curriculum. And then look at, down the line, I believe in 2022, possibly making this a mandatory requirement, which this bill does not do. It just strongly encourages it. Other states right now, though, I believe Maryland and Oregon are both looking at bills that would mandate this for the younger students as well.
I think it was ninth grade that we saw the basically the Allied liberation footage from the from the concentration camps. And it wasn't censored in any way. We saw the skeletal people and the piles of bones and the lampshades and the whole thing, and it was pretty brutal. But obviously, a lasting. I assume you saw it stuff too, right?
Yeah, I did. Actually, both my husband and I asked when I was surprised when I saw this that it wasn't already taught in the younger grades. And I believe I grew up in California, but I know I had it in sixth grade. My husband said he believed
sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, well, I mean, yeah, there's nothing too controversial about that, is there?
You wouldn't think so. So I haven't seen much in the way of pushback. We'll see how this proceeds.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Hannah Scott. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and joined by Rachel Bell. Do you have television?
I technically have a television, but I haven't had cable since 1999.
Well, how do you watch TV then?
I have Hulu and Netflix. But before about a year ago, I didn't have either, and I just still rented DVDs.
Wow.
But my video store just closed a couple months ago, so that's done.
You were just watching really old editions of the Cairo 6 o'clock news? Is that what it was?
Exactly. I was watching Full House on DVD and just like reading and cleaning my house and stuff.
Well, anyway, here's the thing about having cable, Rachel. Every so often, your bill creeps up perpetually, and then once you look at it one day, because it's all online, I never look at it. One day you log in, look at it, and say, holy cow, I'm paying this much for cable? So you call the cable company, and you say, I can't believe I'm paying this much for cable. Can you lower my bill? And they always say, yes, they can, but you'll have to get a new piece of equipment, which is usually the modem. You know what the modem is?
Sort of.
That's the magic box that lets you get the internet on your TV.
Okay.
So without that, you get nothing. And with people like me who have their phone through cable, without that box, you don't get phone either. So I'm always worried when you're changing an essential piece of equipment like that. It's sort of like doing, you know, a heart transplant on yourself. If it goes wrong, basically that's it, right?
Yeah.
So I go down to the cable company and I rip out my old modem, you know, so the whole house is now dark for internet and dark for phone. So this is a very high stakes trip to the cable company. And I go down there, I make the appointment. And they say, okay, thank you for the old box. Here's your new box. And I say, are there any directions that come with this? They said, no, just bring up the app on your phone, and it will practically install itself.
So now you have to get the app on your phone.
You know what I'm thinking at this point. This is never going to work. But I trust him. So I go back to the house, and I hook it up as directed. And I'm pretty good at doing that. I put the app on the phone, and I press the app, and it goes around and around in a while. And then it says, we have a little problem. Start again. So I said, this is my worst fear now.
Did it at least come with a paper bag so you could hyperventilate into it?
I got my own paper bags for that. Even though the app didn't work, they did give me a phone number which I could call. And here's the best part. When I called the phone number, it only took about 5 minutes to get to a human voice who knew what was going on and fixed my problem.
Yay!
By sending magical signals to my new cable box and turning the light from blinking red, which, as she explained, is bad, to blinking green, which she said, that's better, to finally a solid white light, which she said, that's good. That means that your phone is back and your cable is back. And then my internet speed was like triple. Triple!
Wow, it was worth it all along.
Yes, it was. Now, does that make my life simpler? Not necessarily, but at least it didn't make it worse.
So Marie Kondo is really huge right now. If you haven't read the book or seen her on Netflix, she is a tiny Japanese woman who is trying to tell you to clean out your house and only keep things that spark joy. And so when I was listening, you know, to what's been going on with your cable company experience, even though it was a good one, you had to do all these steps. I also realized that besides the fact that I haven't had cable since 1999, so I've never had to be home between 1 and 5 o'clock for the cable guy to come. The last two places I've lived, including where I live now, have just coincidentally, my utilities are included in the rent. Mm-hmm. So I haven't even had to pay a utility bill directly for about 5 years.
Wow.
My phone bill is also paid by another party. And so I just realized that I don't ever have to deal with anybody who people don't like to deal with. The only people I end up having to call is like my insurance or something like that. So I was thinking, you know, how worth it is it to have cable? I think mostly sports fans end up wanting to have cable because that's how you can get, you know, the games and not just shows. But what are you willing to give up? Like, are these things stressful enough that you'd be willing to get rid of some of these things in your digital life that would make your life less cluttered and better?
Well, I don't know. You've opened a whole Pandora's box there because I have the pleasure of being a homeowner, so I pay for everything a la carte.
Yes.
The utilities, the heating, the garbage, replacing the roof, replacing the windows, pulling up the carpet, cleaning. So, I mean, I've got no chance.
And now we have these weird Pavlovian responses to these blinking lights. You know, you see something in your house blinking and you start getting stressed kind of immediately.
That's for sure.
I have that too. You know, it's like if your internet takes, you know, a couple extra seconds to kind of load up, it's like, oh no, everything's slowing down. I mean, we have all
the Russians are attacking.
It's,
yes,
it's true. Oh my, what is going on with my, I think I'm becoming a man today. I think that's what's happening. I'm having radio puberty.
We're gonna do that segment tomorrow. Well, thank you, Rachel.
You're welcome. Sorry about my froggy tendencies.
Yeah. Tomorrow's going to be even more interesting than today.
Mm-hmm, it will be. That's what they tell us anyway. That's called optimism.
That's called a whole different segment.